I'm reminded of a few years ago when we were sitting at Bloedel Hall at St. Mark's, and the Tuesday happened to land on Christmas Day. So I said, well, yeah, we'll have it. You know, it seems like a fine way to spirit Christmas in. And so we came, gathered at 7 o'clock with the backing of St. Mark's Cathedral. They knew we were coming, but they had the doors locked. And so we didn't, you know, so went around and knocked on all the relevant buildings, but no one seemed to be home. And so Ellen, my wife, found a loose window and crawled in the window. This is a true story. And we broke in to Bloedel Hall on Christmas Day. And actually, it was a very, very nice gathering. It was a very warm gathering. So this one happens to fall on a Tuesday, but this is the 28th, not the 25th. So I thought it would be fun to just ask whatever you would like to ask dharmically, and we'll see what can respond. You can all, so if the Christmas spirit is in you, the relativity of what you've been through in terms of the Christmas lights and shows and the Buddha's silence and quietude and the expression of Christ and the expressions of the Buddha, those are all relevant questions as well. So anyone have anything they would like to ask? Yes, sir. The relative question, the question has to do with the relationship that one has with teacher or teachers and the place that that fits in practice. Well, I'm very indebted to the many teachers I've had over the years, but that dedication and appreciation, and there's extraordinary gratitude whenever a teacher's image comes up in my mind, or whether I pass a picture of him or her, it almost overwhelms me just to bow and acknowledge the exchange that often has occurred during those times. But the one thing I never allowed to happen, except once mistakenly, was to dedicate my practice an allegiance to the teacher, as opposed to the sense of rightful direction in myself. And what I mean by rightful direction is that I sensed that what this person was saying was relevant to where I was in my own practice, and I would stay as long as I felt that teaching to feed me. And you know when something feeds you, you feel it. But when it began to be more about the teacher and my loyalty to him or her, and not so much about being fed, I realized that my time had come when I needed to move on. And I really encourage each of you to have that sense of primary direction, that you know when you're being fed, and sometimes teachings from a particular teacher can feed you for a considerable length of time. But there will be a time when you've been saturated by that particular vocabulary the teacher uses, or the metaphors, or the way they arrange Dharma. And in that sense, you know that it's better to move on to a different and crisper voice, so that that feeds you in a way that you can further explore the teaching. Because if you just hear the same thing in the same way, at least it was that way for me, I get dull in the way I construct my images of Dharma around those words. It dulls me. But if I hear a new way of hearing the Dharma, that suddenly it all opens up again and I can move in that direction. So the loyalty in this tradition is never to the teacher. And that's especially important when we get hooked up in very exclusive sanghas. And there are many around that were very inspirational or charismatic teachers, ones that you can feel the energy in the system itself. And sometimes that takes over our guidance system, so that the loyalty then comes to the feeling of heightened energy or arousal that a teacher can bring. And that requires a cold shower and some somber reflection, and to move out of that as quickly as possible. Save yourself the time and trouble of that. So there are times when you can do it alone, and teachings reveal themselves through books or through recordings or whatever. And there are times when the interpersonal exchange, for most people, is extremely important, because if a teacher has known you for a while, they know your patterns, and hopefully they use those patterns to benefit you, and so that to open up and benefit your Dharma. And so having somebody know you from sort of the inside out, and the patterns that have formed your life, can be very helpful. But you have to have trust in the teacher. And the trust in the teacher varies. I mean, teachers are human beings. One thing you should look for, or I think it's important, is the sincerity of the teacher. If his intention or hers intentionality is in alignment with their sincerity. Now, it doesn't mean that their sincerity sometimes doesn't step on people's toes and make mistakes. But that's more easily forgiven when you realize it's a mistake in line with the sincerity and intention of the person's teaching, as opposed to being mean or just or undermining the person. So there are guideposts along the way, and you have to learn what it means to trust and how to trust and who to trust in order for this thing to move forward. And some people, because of the backgrounds, and they're buried, of course, in terms of trust, have a very poor trust factor. They just stay very circumscribed and don't ever look out for the possibility of a trusting relationship. And if that resonates with anyone here in the room, I really do suggest that you start meeting the moment as a trusting element, and then expanding that meeting of the moment to include people within it. Because there's nothing more trusting than here and now. And once we can put our feet on the floor and know that we are in our exact location, then you can start bringing in relationships within that location and make that part of the trust of the surround. So do it slowly and do it in accordance with your own willingness and timing, but don't stay encased within mistrust, because the Dharma really requires a trusting relationship. Ultimately, it requires a trusting relationship with all things. It doesn't mean that we're naive or that we allow ourselves to get bowled over, you know, or walk in bad neighborhoods. Not at all. There's discernment that is there, but there's a relationship to life that is a relaxed repose rather than a tight tension. And so much of our anxiety comes from the mistrust of our past, which is no longer present, and we no longer allow the present to inform us in a new way to trust. So that's my answer.
Yes. So I'm really curious, like you say, this thing will be born. And so I'm curious as to the landscape past, like as you move forward, past, like I've said, stillness and quiet, and what that looks like.
Past it?
You know, as you deepen your practice.
Right.
Just as you deepen your practice.
Right.
Moving this thing forward.
Right.
So, you know, you get past it, you know, you're in the stillness.
Right.
Quiet.
Right.
And it's, so, does one reside more in the formless? Unless you are...
Reside more in the formless? Formless.
Unless you're in contact and you have to do something, then
right.
You go back and forth, but only...
Right.
You know, when you...
Right, no, I get the question.
Okay.
But thank you for that. So the question has to do with what it looks like as we grow in the Dharma, as we move forward. What's our relationship to stillness, to the form, to the formless, and how does all that manifest, and how does that all that look within one's life? Huh? I'll approach this from a couple of different angles. I will use the Christian Christmas metaphor, if I can, for one angle of it. And that is that you can see that, you know, Christmas in its true meaning has been drowned out by the expression, not of generosity, but of things, of the relevance and appreciation and love and pleasure of things. The gratitude, the generosity becomes secondary to the things. And of course, from my point of view, Christ himself was much more about the generosity. But that gets overweight. So if I can just look at the movement of Dharma from towards generosity as opposed to thingness, what does that look like? Well, you know, it looks like toys that satisfy for a week and then get tossed aside or broken or become obsolete next year or the next toy, you know, all of that. That it looks like dependency. It looks like trying to make the life work by gathering conditions around you. And those conditions, you get bored with them. No matter what conditions you build around you, even the palaces, you know, you get bored. It's just the sameness. And so what happens is that the world, according to things, loses its enamoration. It's not appealing to us anymore. And then what happens is that once we become, let's say, disenchanted with those things, that energy that went towards making things relevant to my life comes back into our life rather than out to the things. And as it comes back into our life, we rediscover gratitude. Because gratitude is the natural expression of life that is more interconnected than individuated. And so as I put less emphasis on things, the more life as an embodiment, as a completion, as a whole, as a total, begins to be sensed. And then natural expressions of that wholeness begin to emanate from us. One of them is gratitude and generosity. It feels good to give, which is where I think the spirit initially was in giving during this time, was that it highlighted the beauty and remarkable purity of generosity itself. And so that's one way this thing moves forward. Okay? So let me look at a different way it moves forward. And I'll bring these two lines into contact. So in order to have the things of the world, we have to use words to separate ourselves from those things. If we stop using words, those things and ourselves have no differentiation. You have to take my word for this until you experience it. But the reason something exists external to me is because I keep telling myself the story of its existence separate from me. I have to constantly repeat that story in image when I see something. Automatically, it's external to me. So that story is immersed within the image of the things I see. So it takes a lot of wording to keep the world distant from ourselves. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work. So we get tired of that. At some point, you just want to know what relaxation and contentment really looks like. And as we do so, we get quieter because we realize that the more we speak, we feel the tension of having to speak and the distance it intrudes upon myself and the rest of the world. And I realize that in the rare moments that I actually am speechless, the world doesn't appear to be that distant. Now, that's a remarkable insight. And it's one that if we're so geared to the mechanics of the practice, we'll never experience, because the mechanics of the practice is wording ourselves forward in our spiritual development. I've got to do this, and this is, you know, how's this, and what qualities have I got here, there? It's really decoration. It's like a tree with a lot of ornaments, you know, that I've got my samadhi and my compassion and my the star of, you know. But you see, the reason that appeals to us is that most of us are not ready for the implications of quietude upon ourselves. It implies something about ourselves, not just about the world. It would be nice if I could stay the way I am and have the world come to me. But in order for the world to come to me, I can't stay the way I am. And when I get quieter, those two things come together, the world and myself, through quietude, not through my wanting it to happen. And when we perceive the world from quietude, we're perceiving it from emptiness, not from the self-fulfillment and self-ideology and the self-image that most of us live with day after day that requires the ongoing reinforcement of, I know who I am when I stand in the mirror, and all of our words. And most of us are suspicious of selflessness. It's not that we don't feel ready for it. We feel like we have all conjured up all kinds of possibilities that word could mean for us. Being swept away, being in a desert, isolated, negated, dismissed, vacuous, invisible. I mean, those are the kind of images that come up when you think of selflessness from a psychological point perspective. But none of that is even relevant to the word. And so instead of staying within the fear of what the word, we fear the word, where the word will lead us, and actually seeing what quietude does to us, because once we have developed a taste for it, you will find nothing more beneficial. But there's that fear. And when people get close to quiet, oftentimes there's traumas that erupt and early childhood experiences that cause disarray and panic attacks about what this means to me and who I will be and all of that. And that seems to be the real inhibitor for moving this in a wise direction forward. I promise you all that it's far safer than your thoughts will ever project it to be. And at some point you're going to have to make a decision on whether you want to continue the noise of your life or whether you're going to try out this new paradigm. Because it's waiting. It's not some distant. And that's why when we make that decision, all seeking has ended. Because seeking is another form of noise. It's another form of expressing the distance between ourselves and what we want when there, in fact, is no distance. It's getting tired. It's becoming so fatigued by the self-generated difficulties of the world that at some point we don't care what lies on the other side. I can't stay on this side. It's just intolerable. And then it lines up. For most of us, we'll cross it several times. And then we'll scurry back, and we'll cross it several times, and we'll scurry back. And what much of my teaching has meant to do is to get you close to it in a mutually designed way where we're all willing to be silent together, where we can see the synergistic possibilities of individual quietude, and the feeling that often accompanies that is an extraordinary safety and compatibility and deep inward resonance. But our mind is on scramble. It's like, you know, it's like, what's going on here? What's he doing to me? It's like, oh, what's this quiet, you know? And if we can just feel it from the body rather than the mind, just let the body feel what, let it soak it in. It becomes an acquired taste, as Narayan likes to say, and which you seek the conditions for crossing it, rather than it stumbling upon them, you seek it. And once it's being sought, you see, and once you know it and it's being sought, then the whole spiritual journey shortens immediately. You get very sincere, the distance gets very, very close. The end of seeking anything anywhere is no more. And there is a sensing, even in troubled times, and believe me, you know, troubled times continue to occur, but it doesn't fool. It's not like, oh, I've got to, you know, go on retreat, or I've got to go to the mountaintop, or I've got to go see guru, whatever. It's like, okay, troubled times, scramble, okay. And this extraordinary patience comes in, and it's like a glider plane, you know, that it's just a soft landing here, rather than the frenetic activity that we usually pit against any difficulty. And so quietude is another access point. My intention in the continuum's talk was to show you so many different accesses that certainly one of them must have resonated. And you go, that's my path, from noise to quiet, or from contraction to love, or whatever it might have been. let me just get on that path with some sincerity, because every path will take you through every other. You're not going to bypass love by being quiet, because the very act of standing in stillness is love. All of them cross, all of them intersect. So just pick one. Pick the one that delights your heart. And then move it forward. Is there love for this too? Is there love for that too? You see, that's where the intention supersedes the reactivity. Is there love for that too? Reframing it. Now, here's something that I wanted to mention today in some context. I think I'll do it now. Is that we're very good at sort of penciling in or writing notes to ourselves of what we need to do, but very few of us actually embody the Dharma. We're very good Dharma students. But at this point, some of us should be well endowed within the Dharma. That there's an abiding there, and that when crisis comes up, there shouldn't be this flurry of looking through the chapters to find out what text the Buddha said in this situation. Just surrender. Let it in. See what's there. Allow what is occurring. So that becomes the default position for our life. And for some reason, I find that even students of many decades are slow to find that recourse. An example is the election. In Dharma communities, the amount of hostility and anger and just wringing, you know, your hands and how awful this is. And I said, where are you all? And I don't mean you, I mean all of us. Where are we all? The Buddha never said, you know, Trump wasn't going to be elected. You won't find that. You will find that conditions change. He made points. Conditions will change. And the Dharma is the movement within those conditions, the ability to accommodate. It doesn't mean, and this is what we fear, I think, is that somehow we'll be, you know, we'll just be passive and just give up all the heartfelt goodness to this very degrading verbal exchanges that are going on now. But that doesn't happen. As we get quieter, the heart expands, the goodness expands, and we are going to make a concerted effort in voice or in action. If things get to the point where they seem very troubling, my voice will be out there, and I hope yours will be too. But it won't be in terms of sword fighting. It's not going to be a sword fight for me. And if they bring a sword, then they can cut off my head. That's it. And they have to deal with the impact that has on them. But they will get my voice, and they will get my body and action if this gets ugly. But we don't have to worry about that. We only have one way. And we're already engaged sufficiently. Just don't make it sword fighting. Don't get it confused. Don't let the circuitry of the Dharma get confused to become more brutal, to become another form of brutality. You're not going to get passive. You don't have to be afraid of that. Let something else take over for you, within you, besides your righteousness. Yes, dear.
to work with feelings and
emotions. What's the purpose of emotion? She's learned all the Dharma tricks of how to keep them from becoming too personally, keep yourself from becoming too personally involved within them. What's the purpose of an emotion? Well, I mean, it depends. That's got me stumped. I'm not sure there's a purpose to an emotion. Okay, that doesn't mean that there... okay, so let me explain. I'll take it back. Okay. So there's a state of vulnerability. Let's say... put yourself in a place or a time when you felt very vulnerable. I can put myself in... 9/11, as I watch the planes hit the towers, and you just there's nothing. You feel helpless, totally exposed and vulnerable. Now, okay, so what happens then is that I don't like being this is the sequence. I don't like feeling vulnerable. Now, it's just not a conscious thing. Unconsciously, I don't like, so I try to cover it up. So vulnerability is very powerless. I don't have any power when I'm vulnerable. What I want is power in this situation as I see people attacking other citizens. And so the emotion that gives me power is anger. So now, as a defense against vulnerability, I get angry. So what anger did for me was it gave me power, or a sense of power, in view of the potential destruction or threat that was occurring. All right? And so from the mind's point of view, the relevance of anger is that it gives you an empowered spirit, you know, so that you can deal with whatever it is that's coming at you. Okay? Now let's look at it for a moment. Is that a use? Because what if I stayed vulnerable? What if I didn't move quickly to a compensating emotion that seemed to offer me protection? Seemed to offer me protection. What if I just stayed vulnerable? I would feel the pain of what I was witnessing. I would feel raw, almost naked to the tragedy that was occurring. And I would feel this tremendous empathetic response to people jumping out the windows of these towers, right? And I'd be totally involved in the situation. And my heart would want to would want to fly to New York and do whatever I could for those people. And many New Yorkers did just that. In fact, some New Yorkers told me that it changed the city. Okay? Now, which one was the more appropriate response? One, in terms of personal power and the fear of being open and at self-risk, I decided that anger was the appropriate response. But anger, how it responds is it does the same thing. It's an eye for an eye. We'll go get them, which is what we did. We'll go get them. All right? I'm not saying that putting somebody in jail is an inappropriate response. I'm just saying that anger is an inappropriate response. And love is not, because love heals. I'm rushing toward those people who are endangered. And the discernment of love says, we've got to stop this nonsense. We've got to make sure whoever did this to us doesn't do that again. Okay? And I'm not elaborating on how that looks, because I don't know. The state of love doesn't know that. It knows it has to stop. Okay, so that's... But it also moves towards the disaster. It doesn't try to strengthen itself, and in doing so, separate itself from the disaster. So what's the point of anger? I don't know. It's a mental, it's a mentally created form of protection for the egoic sense of self. It creates the distance that we're trying to cross in our spiritual journey. It's a form of grief, but instead of going to the grief, which in fact is vulnerability, I better and would rather stay angry so that I don't even have to feel grief. And yet, I cannot think of a single episode of anger that isn't laced and tied to grief. The loss of something important to you is why we get angry. Some view or value has been... So you see, you have to look at emotions from whether it benefits the sense of me and the self and the separation that we're trying to cross in spirituality, or is there a way to navigate this thing so that I can actually cross that divide? And tender emotions such as patience, generosity, love, compassion, etc., are those emotions, and why they're emphasized in spiritual growth, because they have us walk over the dividing line. They have us cross the divide rather than to create more separation. So we have to be careful with where we invest our energy and emotion. But most of us don't have the opportunity to even think about that. We're just all of a sudden angry. And so the Vipassana scene, insight scene, tries to build a sense of that all emotions are conditioned phenomena. They're just coming to you. Given a certain repetitive past, when certain things occurred, from a sense of egoic stance, I got angry. So when those conditions come in the present moment, my memory says, this is the time I get angry, and anger comes out. And it's just that repetition and conditioned reference, I've been hurt, and I'm supposed to get angry. There's a whole conversation that goes on, this is not acceptable. It comes out. And we can't stop that self-talk long enough to see if there's an option to feeling the grief and the exposure of where anger was in reaction. And so giving us some distance by seeing that emotions are just phenomena that are arising and are not personally owned. Personal owned means I have a story associated with it. That's how we personally own anything, an emotion. I have a personal story with anger. I have a history with it. I know exactly what it does for me. And given the right situation, I want to be angry. So we have to break that solidification our words give us by just seeing it for what it is. That's the first step. It's not the final step. It's the first step of seeing phenomenon as themselves rather than as to what we have made them to be. So what's the point of anger? I don't know. I don't think there is a point. It keeps you divided. If that's what you want, then anger will be one of the systems in which you continue to do that. Impatience will be another. Fear will be another. Irritation, annoyance, frustration. All of that. They're just codes of separation. Nuances of separation. But at the same time, we can't say, okay, I'm not, anger never again. Like I had a very well-practiced friend who says, I'm never going to feel angry. I made myself up. Well, You don't have any choice. What this thing manifests is not, you're not responsible for how it manifests. And if anger's in your system, it will come out. Your job is to be accountable for what comes out, not to be responsible that it comes out. And when it comes out, acknowledging it, first seeing it, cuts the link that forces it into a particular historical pattern with us. Okay. Is there another question?
Wise effort.
Wise effort. You see, this is a... Okay, I don't know if I mentioned this in my Stay Within Yourself talk, but I wanted to if I didn't. So this is a good... taps me back in. So I'm... I like to teach effortlessness. Why? Because we're a culture where, you know, hard work and, you know, the, you know, put in your time and, you know, white knuckle approach to most of life is how we are all conditioned. And so we try that when we get a spiritual task. We try to white knuckle our way through it. And it creates so much not only tension, turmoil, self-hatred, because we're never good enough, and it reinforces our self-image, which is often around some aspect of unworthiness. And all of that is being conditioned by the tension that we're bringing to our spiritual pursuit. And we don't even know that, because we only have eyes for how many breaths I can be on, and I'm improving, and I don't give a damn what I'm doing to myself on my way to improvement. Okay, time out. Time out. Okay, this is about suffering and the end of suffering. So you can now stay on 5 breaths instead of 1, right? Good. And how much tension have you accumulated, and angst and fear along that increase of 4 breaths? Doesn't matter. Yes, it does. Because that's what you're going to live with long after you've mastered your breath. You have now conditioned that into your fabric. Okay, I got it. So now what do I do? Well, let's try to couple relaxation and concentration together so that I relax my way into concentration. This is an amazing... Wow, yeah, so the more I relax, the easier the concentration becomes. And it was actually my effort that kept it so full of tension and the breath so far away from one another. So as I begin to practice from that angle, and in fact in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha says something like, once your mind has left your breath, just relax. The breath will find you. You don't have to go searching for it. Those are my words, not his. Ah, there's the breath. Okay, what a beautiful way to have the breath return. It's not brutal. It's friendly. But when we're from the culture, encultured within that, you know, I am not trying hard enough, it feels like we're not doing enough. And so getting over this sense of having to do something. Now, as we progress beyond the breath, you find that this urge to do something is actually self-negating, in the sense that we feel... something in us is missing, and we have to compensate for that missing quality by struggling to gain something back. And so we keep putting in effort where we think we're we have some limitation. That's called spiritual practice. All spiritual practice. And we have to, you can't just say to a student, don't do that. Because there's a timing and a readiness to hear that that has a limitation. And most people have to go through a long history of struggle before they hear, and before they feel this, the end of struggle. So the teacher talks to everyone. He doesn't talk to the students who are ready. So I say this, and so everybody goes, okay, no effort, all right? I'm going to do just what he says. And you're like falling apart, you know? You're not ready for that teaching. And not because you haven't given enough effort, it's just that there's a readiness to insight, there's a readiness to open. And at some point, you will be. It's not, so you can say to yourself, no, you know, I really still need that validation of my practice. So I'm going to, I don't care what he says. And that's staying within yourself. Or other people will say, well, he hit a note there. And even if you're not ready, you can say, well, I'm not ready to hear that, but I hear it. And at some point, I'll bring it in, but not now. But at least you haven't dismissed it. And other people say, well, that's the perfect thing I need to hear. And sometimes, you know, there's that person over there and that person over there. This one says, God, that was the perfect talk. And this one said, I didn't understand the thing you said. And you have all of that in the room together. All right? So that's why staying within yourself is so important. Ultimately, okay, just remember what I just said, because I'm going to go way out there. Ultimately, any form of effort is self-creation. The sense of I doing something establishes the I. The I was not there before the effort. The effort and I arose together. And with the subtlety and nuance of insight, you go, wait a second here. Anything I do is too much. And then we are in the perfect seat for transformation. Now you say, I'm going to try that. Go ahead, it's okay. But if you get frustrated, just notice your frustration. You know, just keep bringing what's behind you in front of you, and you'll be doing fine. Don't take what's behind you as the truth so that you develop a counter action to negate what's behind you. Do you understand what I just said? Okay. Because that was really important. So that should be for everybody. Whatever I'm doing, I need to know the motivation for why I'm doing it. Is it in reaction to the motivation? I feel frustrated. I've got to, you know, I feel discontent, and I've got to, you know, something's wrong with my practice. No, nothing's wrong with your practice. You just aren't exposing yourself to the discontentedness. You're negating that as a statement of you that has to do something to get over your discontentedness. You're already doing something way more than you should be doing. Let me bring in what's behind me and put it on my lap. That's the most complete statement anyone could make of the moment. Most inclusive statement. With your intention to see it.
Right. So because I was thinking that, I was thinking this is, you know, your final talk. talk, and I was thinking what arises for me in that relax, observe, allow, and curiosity. Those seem to me to kind of are easy for me to hold on to and follow in all sorts of situations and use. And that my understanding of relax, observe, allow is really different from when I started, but I could use it when I started it. And now I'm still using it, but it's
more subtle.
Yeah. And that, it's
beautiful, Lauren. Yes. Beautiful. She's saying that the words that she heard me say when we first we did an introductory class, relax, observe, and allow, over time has enriched your practice in subtlety so that those words mean something different to you now. And when I can, let me put it, when something's behind you, it's only behind you because you're resisting it. You see, so relaxing is going to drop that resistance. Observation is the willingness to see what's there, and the allowance is a willingness to have it manifest without any argument.
Yeah, and it also brings love to me.
A small little thing. She says it also brings love. Yes, it brings love. Now, if it's bringing love to you and you realize that, you're actually switching paradigms at that point. You're letting that setup, relax, observe, and allow, which are from a different paradigm than a mind's paradigm, which is control, resist, and flee. and don't see, deny, control, resist, and whatever. So anytime we do anything counter to the pattern of self-protection, which all of those later words enhanced, you know, we're going to become porous. You're not going to be empowered when you relax or when you see. And yet you can see what it brings love. So you know you're on the right track. And this thing is getting more refined in you so that you're bringing those words to meet your experience at an ever-increasing subtle level, which is beautiful. What I think Michelle asked about moving forward. That's the system. That's how you know it. Okay? That's how you know it. And it's a complete practice, isn't it? What else do you need to do? Right? And it takes you out of it, and it's effortless, really. I mean, what's the effort in relaxation? The effort is in holding on, not in relaxing. Where's the effort in observing? I might not want to see it, but that's the resistance. If I just, you know, you see what's in front of your eyes, it's like it's there. And allowing is what you do when you're not arguing. So it's like this beautiful packaging. Right, good. So the question is this where we can bring emotions back in? Absolutely. We're not negating emotions. I'm not saying they're bad or wrong or they shouldn't be there. It's just that we need to know their derivation. If I identify with them, what they're going to do to me. And, you know, then you get very serious about seeing what your emotions rather than investing in their energy. And as we get very interested in witnessing all the emotions, full embrace, the full spectrum, because we all have the full spectrum, you begin to see that each of them have a vulnerability associated with them. When I'm with anger, you know, it's to cover up that vulnerability, but if I can re-expose it and feel the vulnerability of being angry. And then there's love for anger in that moment, because I'm not being carried away with the mind drift of anger. I'm actually experiencing the vulnerability of why I protect myself with anger to begin with. And that renews myself in relationship to emotion. All this just does is take a willingness. I'm not saying anything. The truth is not being held back from anyone. Anyone. If you want it, you will see. It will be given. It's absolutely true. You don't have to form yourself into some specialized spiritual being. You don't have to wear robes or special environments. You just have to want to see. You want to know the truth. And if you don't, that's where I would go in your practice, is why don't I want to know the truth? What's stopping me? What's limiting me? Why am I holding myself back? Not as a damnation, but as a curiosity. What's going on in me that makes me want to deny this fact? Now you're back square in the truth again. So it's never any further than your sincerity. But the sincerity has to be there, or, you know, you see how it all feeds. Everything feeds itself. It's really, now, my leaving is the Dharma. Things come and things go. And each of us, regardless of our relationship, need to see the appropriateness of that fact. It's appropriate. It's time. When people were dying in hospice, often, I would see that it was appropriate for that person to be dying. Not because they were 70, you just feel it. You just feel that their life had come to this final statement. And so too, so I'd like to read a final poem. And I'm currently in my W.S. Merwin phase. And this one's called Finding a Teacher. In the woods, I came on an old friend fishing, and I asked him a question. And he said, wait. Fish were rising in the deep stream, but his line was not stirring. But I waited. It was a question about the sun, about my two eyes, my ears, my mouth, my heart, the earth with its four seasons, my feet, where I was standing, where I was going. It slipped through my hands as though it were water into the river. It flowed under the trees. It sank under halls far away. It was gone without me. Then, where I stood, night fell. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line had no hook. I understood that I was to stay and eat with him. Finding a teacher. Can we just sit for a minute? Thank you for the years of allowing me to share the Dharma. Thank you. I have done my best. And sometimes I have transgressed so that people were upset with me. And for that, I am deeply remorseful. But it came from my sincerity, not from my cruelty. And I ask if I have at all transgressed with any of you, that you forgive me. Thank you.